am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. I'm so glad you're back. Last time we sat together, I told you about a Spanish mystic named John of the Cross, a man who found light in the deepest darkness, who wrote some of the most beautiful poetry in human history from inside a prison cell. I think about him often. I think about what it means to carry something luminous in a place designed to extinguish it. Today, I want to tell you about another Spaniard, another man who carried something the world wasn't quite ready for. But where John turned inward, into prayer, into silence, into the dark night of the soul, this man turned outward, into books, into bodies, into the structure of the cosmos itself. His name was Michael Servetus, and he had the particular misfortune of being right about too many things at once. Pull up a chair. This one matters. I want you to picture a room in Geneva, 1553. It is tidy, serious, spare, the way John Calvin liked things. A writing table, good light from a narrow window, the kind of room that tells you immediately what kind of man lives in it. No excess, no softness, everything in its place. In case you're wondering, John Calvin was one of the architects of the Protestant Reformation, a theologian of towering influence who had made Geneva into his own model of a godly city. Yes, that John Calvin. And into this office space, a manuscript has arrived. Calvin knows who sent it. He and this man have been exchanging letters for years. Sharp, brilliant, increasingly hostile letters. A long argument conducted across the distances of Reformation Europe. Calvin had even sent his own masterwork, The Institutes, to this correspondent, hoping, perhaps, to settle the matter. Instead, the manuscript came back covered in marginal notes. Challenges. Corrections. The audacity of it still stings. Now this. I watched him read. Or I imagine I did. I have seen that expression on enough faces across enough centuries to know exactly what it looks like, the jaw tightening, the eyes moving faster. The moment a reader stops engaging with a text and starts building a case against it, he was reading theology, dangerous theology, a frontal assault on the doctrine of the Trinity, argued with extraordinary force and learning. That was what he saw. That was what filled the room for him. But here is what I noticed. Partway through the manuscript, almost without transition, the argument shifts. Suddenly, Servetus is describing the human body, the heart, the lungs, the movement of blood. He is explaining, with quiet precision, as if it is simply the next logical point, that blood does not pass through the wall of the heart the way everyone believed. It travels instead into the lungs, where it is transformed, vivified, returned to the heart, changed. He is describing accurately and for the first time in European medicine what we now call pulmonary circulation. And then, just as smoothly, he returns to scripture. For Servetus, there was no seam there. The blood, the breath, the spirit, it was one continuous inquiry. He was not a physician who also did theology or a theologian who dabbled in medicine. He was something rarer and stranger than that, a mind that simply could not see the wall most people took for granted. Calvin turned the page. He wasn't interested in the lungs. He had already decided what this document was. A heresy. A threat. Something that could not be allowed to stand. I don't think he ever really saw what was on that page. And that, my friend, is where our story begins. Michael Servetus was born sometime around 1511 in Aragon, in the northeast of Spain. The exact date is uncertain. Even he seemed unsure and gave different answers at different times. That small uncertainty feels appropriate somehow. He was a man who slipped between categories his whole life. His father was a notary, minor nobility, a respectable man. The family had roots in a tiny Pyrenean hamlet called Serveto, which is where the name came from. But on his mother's side, the story gets more complicated. Her family were conversos, Jews who had converted to Christianity, willingly or otherwise, under the long pressure of the Inquisition. Servetus himself denied this at his trial in Geneva, insisting his family were Christians of ancient race. He knew what that admission would cost him. He was extraordinary from the beginning. By his early 20s, he had studied law at Toulouse, liberal arts at Zaragoza, and found his way into the retinue of Emperor Charles V, traveling through Italy and Germany as a page to the emperor's own confessor. He was present at the coronation of Charles as Holy Roman Emperor in Bologna. He watched the Pope arrive in golden splendor, and something in him recoiled. That moment seems to have cracked something open. He left the imperial court, made his way to Basel, then Strasbourg, and began talking, urgently, perhaps recklessly, to the leading reformers of the day. Ecolampadius, Martin Bucer. He was 20 years old, and he wanted to argue about the Trinity. They were not ready for him. In 1531, he published his first theological bombshell, De Trinitatis Erroribus, on the errors of the Trinity. He was perhaps 19 or 20. The reformers were appalled. They had broken with Rome over corruption and authority, not over the foundational doctrines of Christianity. Servetus was doing something far more radical, going back to the original Greek texts of Scripture and asking whether the Trinity had any basis there at all. It was too much, too fast, too dangerous. He disappeared. Under the alias Michel de Villeneuve, he reinvented himself in France. He studied medicine in Paris, where his teachers praised him as one of their most gifted students. He worked as a physician in the prosperous city of Vienne, earned a fine reputation, published respected medical texts. For nearly two decades, he lived quietly, carefully, as someone else entirely. But he never stopped thinking, never stopped writing. The manuscript he had been building in secret for years, Christianismi Restitutio, the Restoration of Christianity, was finally printed in 1553. He published it anonymously. Only his initials on the dedication page. He thought that might be enough to protect him. It wasn't. Someone recognized the writing. A letter was sent. The Inquisition in Vienne arrested him. He escaped, remarkably, almost improbably, and fled, and then made the single most baffling decision of his life. He went to Geneva, to Calvin's city. I have wondered about that choice for a long time. Perhaps he believed Calvin would hear him out. Perhaps he was simply out of options. Perhaps there is a particular stubbornness that comes with spending your whole life being right and being punished for it. A stubbornness that eventually stops calculating the odds. He was arrested within days of his arrival. He never left. I want to try to explain something that is genuinely difficult to explain. Not because it is complicated, because it is so simple that we have almost lost the ability to see it. Servetus did not think of himself as a scientist who also happened to have religious opinions. He did not think of himself as a theologian who had picked up some useful medical knowledge on the side. Those categories, science over here, faith over there, a wall between them, different methods, different languages, different rooms, that arrangement would have made no sense to him whatsoever. For Servetus, the human body and the sacred text were the same kind of evidence. Both were given. Both could be read. Both rewarded careful attention and punished lazy assumption. When he opened a cadaver and traced the movement of blood through the lungs, he was doing exactly the same thing he did when he opened the Gospel of John and traced the meaning of the word logos back through its Greek roots. He was reading the world as it actually was, not as he had been told it was. That is why the pulmonary circulation appears inside a theological argument. It wasn't a digression. It was proof. The breath, the blood, the animating spirit, to Servetus, these were continuous. The place where air met blood in the lungs was the place where the divine entered the human. His medicine and his theology were not two inquiries that happened to live in the same book. They were one inquiry expressed in two registers. In another century, in a different world, that integration might have been celebrated. In the 16th century, it made him incomprehensible to almost everyone around him. The reformers needed the fight they were actually fighting, against Rome, against corruption, against the selling of indulgences and the abuse of clerical power. They did not need someone dismantling the Trinity on top of everything else. Luther dismissed him. Bucer wanted him gone. Calvin, as we have seen, wanted something considerably worse. And the Catholics were no more receptive. Servetus was not asking to return to Rome. He was asking everyone, reformer and pope alike, to go back before the councils, before the creeds, before the centuries of accumulated doctrine, and look again at what was actually there. That is not a message any institution receives warmly. Institutions exist precisely to protect what has already been decided. What strikes me, watching from where I stand, is how lonely that position must have been. He was not an atheist. He was not a skeptic. He was, by every evidence, a man of deep and genuine faith, a faith that burned hot enough to cost him everything. He believed in God with the same intensity he brought to anatomy. He simply refused to believe that God's truth could be contradicted by what God's own creation revealed when you looked at it carefully and honestly. That refusal was his greatness. It was also his death warrant. The world he lived in had decided on both sides of the Reformation divide that there were limits to how far honest inquiry was permitted to go. You could reform the church, you could translate the Bible, you could challenge the Pope, but you could not come back to the foundational structures of doctrine and say, gently, learnedly, with full citations, "I think we may have gotten this wrong." Servetus said exactly that. And the world, Catholic and Protestant alike, answered him with fire. Here is something that has stayed with me across the centuries. In 1628, 75 years after Servetus died on that hill outside Geneva, an English physician named William Harvey published his own description of how blood circulates through the body. It was meticulous. It was correct. It changed medicine permanently, and Harvey is rightly celebrated for it. He almost certainly never read Servetus. How could he? Three copies of Christianismi Restitutio survived the burning. Three out of an entire print run. They were hidden, scattered, essentially lost to the working world of European medicine. The discovery that Servetus had tucked inside his theology, careful, accurate, ahead of its time by decades, sat in darkness while the rest of medicine slowly, laboriously found its way to the same place by a longer road. I want to sit with that for a moment. Not as tragedy, though it is that, but as a very precise illustration of what happens when we cannot hold two kinds of knowing at the same time. Nobody burned Servetus because of his lungs. They burned him because of his theology. But the lungs burned too. That is the thing about fire. It does not make distinctions. When you condemn a mind, you condemn everything in it. Servetus had understood something that his world was not structured to receive. Not just the medical fact of pulmonary circulation, something larger. He understood that the same quality of attention, honest, careful, willing to be surprised, unwilling to defer to inherited authority when the evidence pointed elsewhere, that same quality worked equally well whether you were reading scripture or reading the human body. The method was the same. The humility required was the same. The courage required was the same. That is not a small insight. That is quietly one of the most consequential ideas in the history of human thought. The centuries after Servetus would be marked by a long and often bitter argument about whether science and religion were enemies, competitors, or strangers with nothing to say to each other. Brilliant people lined up on every side of that argument. Institutions formed around the positions. Wars were fought. Careers were destroyed. Books were banned. Different books this time, but the impulse was recognizable. And all along, in three hidden copies of a condemned book, was a man who had never understood why the argument was necessary, who had looked at the blood moving through the lungs and seen the breath of God in it, and seen no contradiction there at all. He didn't contribute that insight to history by being heard. He contributed it by being a perfect, costly example of what the failure to hold these things together actually looks like. Sometimes history teaches forward. Sometimes it teaches by negative space, by showing us the shape of what was lost. Servetus is that shape, the integrated mind, the unified inquiry, the refusal to decide in advance which questions belong to faith and which belong to reason, as if the universe had posted signs. That idea survived him, slowly, unevenly, with enormous resistance, but it survived. And the world that eventually began to build on it, the world that stopped insisting that honest inquiry had to stay inside its assigned room, that world is in part his inheritance, even if it never knew his name. I want to tell you something that stopped me recently. A research organization called the Pew Research Center asked a large number of Americans a simple question. Do you think science and religion are mostly in conflict or mostly compatible? Half of them said conflict. Half. I have been walking through human history for a very long time. I have sat with mystics in desert caves and watched surgeons map the human body by candlelight. I have listened to astronomers name the stars and heard monks chant the same stars into prayer. And I want to tell you, gently but clearly, that the conflict those people are perceiving is not what they think it is. It is real in the sense that loud voices on both sides have spent centuries insisting it must be so. The scientist who treats faith as superstition, the believer who treats inquiry as threat, they have shouted at each other across a wall that, if you look carefully, was never actually there. Researchers who study this carefully have started to notice something important. They are finding that stereotyping religious people as anti-science and scientists as anti-religion is not only inaccurate, it actively makes the division worse. The noise of the argument creates the appearance of a war that most ordinary people are not actually fighting. Most people live quietly on both sides of that supposed wall every single day. Think about it. When someone you love is sick, really sick, you want the best doctor you can find. You want the tests, the diagnosis, the treatment, the science. And you also, in whatever language feels true to you, reach toward something beyond the science, toward meaning, toward comfort, toward something that looks and sounds like prayer, toward the question that no physician can answer. Why does this person matter so much to me? Nobody in that moment thinks those are competing requests. Nobody stops and says, wait, I must choose. That is because they are not competing. They never were. Science is a method for asking how. How does the blood move? How does the star burn? How does the cell divide? It is a rigorous, beautiful, disciplined way of reading the physical world, and it has given us wonders beyond counting. Faith is a method for asking why. Why does any of this matter? Why is there something rather than nothing? Why do I feel in my best moments that I am part of something larger than myself? They are different instruments reading different frequencies of the same reality. Michael Servetus knew that. It was not a philosophy he had arrived at. It was simply how his mind worked. He moved from scripture to anatomy and back again, the way you move from one room to another in a house you have always lived in. The transition was invisible to him because there was no transition. It was all one inquiry, all one act of attention directed at a world he found endlessly, devotedly astonishing. The institutions of his day could not hold that. They needed the wall. They needed the categories kept clean and the territories defended. And so they did what institutions do when they feel threatened. They reduced a vast and luminous mind to a single label, heretic, and acted accordingly. We lost 75 years of medical understanding because of that choice. We lost the work of an integrated mind that might have shown us earlier and more clearly what happens when you let these two ways of knowing speak to each other. That is the cost of the wall. You do not have to build it. And here is what I have noticed after all my centuries of watching. Most people, when left to themselves, don't. Most people move naturally between wonder and inquiry, between prayer and question, between the sacred and the examined. The conflict lives loudest in the places where someone needs it to. Servetus never needed it to. Neither do you. I want to leave you with a question, not a hard one, a quiet one. Is there a wall in your own life, a place where you have accepted, maybe without even noticing, that two things you love cannot speak to each other? Maybe it is science and faith, exactly as we have been discussing. Maybe you grew up in a tradition that felt threatened by certain questions, and you learned early to keep those questions in a separate room. Or maybe you grew up in a world that treated your spiritual instincts as something slightly embarrassing, something to be kept private away from the serious business of thinking. Or maybe the wall looks different for you entirely, the creative life and the practical life, the heart and the mind. The person you are at work, and the person you are when no one is watching. Servetus didn't build walls. That was his gift, and in his particular moment in history, his undoing. The world he lived in was not ready for someone who refused to keep things separate. But I have watched enough of human history to know that the world moves slowly, unevenly, with tremendous resistance, toward integration, toward wholeness, toward the recognition that the different parts of a life, like the different parts of an inquiry, belong together. You are living in a moment further along that arc than Servetus ever got to see. So I wonder, what would it look like for you to let two things talk to each other that you have been keeping apart, not as a grand gesture, just quietly? Just to see what they might say. He never got to find out. You do. Next time, I want to tell you about a man who survived something that should have broken him entirely. His name was Father John Krestienkin. He was a Russian Orthodox priest who lived through the Soviet gulag, arrested, imprisoned, stripped of everything the state could strip from a person. And yet the people who knew him, who came to him in the years after, described something almost impossible to explain. A quality of presence, a kind of light. He did not come out of that darkness angry. He came out luminous. I have been thinking about what it means to carry something through the worst that the world can do to you, and arrive on the other side not diminished, but somehow more fully yourself. I think you will find his story worth sitting with. But for now, stay with Michael Servetus a little longer if you can. Stay with that image of a man who looked at the blood moving through the lungs and saw in the same moment the breath of God, who never understood why those two things should surprise anyone by being found together. He was not wrong, he was just early. And the world, as it always does, eventually caught up. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.